Blog Talk Radio.
Things move pretty fast on set. I mean, most of the time. But when the cameras are rolling, I'm in the zone. Because when I'm on top of my game, nothing breaks me out of character. Hi, Mousy.
Help improve your concentration in minutes a day with fun exercises specifically designed to help you focus in today's distracted world. Brain Age Concentration Training, only on Nintendo 3DS. Rated E for everyone.
Like to say to some of the past African American leaders,
If we were ever to meet again, or ever to meet, I guess I should say, well done. Some of the ones that we will be discussing tonight definitely deserve that. We will be taking a walk down Black History Lane with our brother, Ronald Hurd II, who does it like no one else I know. He covers the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll probably talk about some that you've heard and maybe some that maybe you haven't. But before we begin, we want to remind you that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. And also, tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog. They're your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at AfricanAmericanNewsAndCommentary.com. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to say to you all, I have been so excited about this show for over a month. My guest and I have talked about this show, and last month he was completely too busy to do the show, and I just waited very patiently, pouting all the way, because I wanted so badly to put this information out there, because when you talk to him or hear him talk about Black history, It kind of mesmerizes you. It puts you into a state of just wanting to just hear him go on and on. And that's what I'm going to give you all tonight. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, let me introduce to you an artist, activist, or also known as the Artivist, and fellow Blog Talk Radio host, Brother Ronald Hurd II. Good evening, Ronald. How you doing?
Thanks, Sister Carrie. I'm blessed and highly favored. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Oh, listen, you know what, I didn't give it justice. I really did. This guy, y'all will see for yourself tonight. I just want to know, before we begin, where did you get this great love for history? Where did that come from?
I don't know. I think it was very weird because I always had a problem. I had a speech impediment problem when I was young. And so I had a hard time communicating with people. Sometimes they just draw pictures to communicate to people what I wanted. If I wanted a hamburger, I had to draw a picture of a hamburger. But I remember, like, in school, I didn't really start making good grades until I was in the fourth grade, really. But I remember in school that kids used to look at me as the smartest person in the room, not because I made good grades, but because I knew about the president. Because when people were reading Dr. Seuss books, I would be reading encyclopedias, and I would be checking out books on biography of great men and women of history. Like, in my mind, if you're reading The Cat in the Hat, I'm reading a biography about Andrew Jackson. You know, and I was just fascinated by people, what made them tick, what made them who they were, and how they was able to find their promise and their potential. I'm always fascinated, and I'll continue to be fascinated by what motivates people to be great.
So you weren't pushed to do this by your parents. This was just a love that you had on your own.
Well, my mom, she's a very profound and beautiful person, Sister Callie Hurd. She always instilled on all of us a love for education and for bettering yourself. And so people by nature, we are naturally curious. But what I have found out over my years is that the system is put in place to beat that curiosity out of you. And interest out of you. Like, look at somebody like Frederick Douglass, who had to, you know, was staying beaten from his slave master because he wanted to read and write. But his passion was so great that the slave master's wife taught him how to read and write. And I think what I learned from stuff like that is that if you have the will to succeed, no one can stop you but you. You can turn every obstacle into an opportunity, to an advantage. Every weakness to a strength if you know what you want in life and you just stay focused on that goal.
Wow. Some of the Black leaders that we're going to be talking about tonight, we don't see those kind of leaders today. What is it that you think has changed about leaders of today as opposed to those that we'll talk about tonight?
Well, the people of yesteryear, I don't want to, you know, broad brush people of today, because a lot of people that are doing phenomenal things in their community, like, great leadership starts at the local level. Before we know the Barack Obamas and all these other folks of the world, they had to start getting the respect of the peers and people of their community. And, you know, the paraphrase of African proverb is that the reason why the young people burned down the village was because they were never invited into the village. They were never made a part of the village. And I think what's lacking now in our leadership that wasn't lacking was the fact that people had a sense that they were in it together. They were forced by the laws of the land to stay within certain, you know, places in the community, to stay in your place. Brooklyn. Education and school, we created hip hop and rap. But every time they try to take us into a negative and turn a negative to a positive. So, man, we have that ability as people to be alchemists of our own destiny if we choose to be. A lot of times, we don't have our self.
We sell ourselves short. We don't understand what we have in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that's the way it's set up. It's been socially engineered like that. You got to think about it. When Caesar came to Egypt, one of the first things those people did was to burn down a library in Alexandria. You know, like Dr. Carter G. Woodson said, if you can't control a person's thinking, you can't control their actions. If you control a person's thinking, how they think, and how they process information, and how they view themselves in the context of the information, then you can't control their actions. So this is what's been going on, because go to a library anywhere in America right now, you'll see more people online on Facebook and YouTube than you do reading books.
Right. Wow, well, then let's get into it, y'all. I'm so excited. Listen, like I said, it's been over a month in the making, so we're going to jump right in. You know, let's just start with Ida B. Wells Barnett. Tell us
about. Well, I love her. She's my dream woman. I love Ida B. Wells Barnett because she was a phenomenal sister. She really cared for the people. And she got an amazing backstory. See, look at how she started. She was born into slavery. And she always had a thirst to try to better herself, a thirst for knowledge, and trying to become a person of excellence. And you look at the fact that, you know, when she was 16 years old, her parents both died from the yellow fever epidemic. Now, her family was very interested, her mother and father. Her father was a carpenter. He actually built the house on the plantation where she was born, down in Holly Springs, Mississippi. And her mom was a very sassy black woman. She had a big mouth on her. But the reason why she stayed alive was because she was the best cook in the South. She was a famous cook in the South, you know, as a slave. So, I mean, she had a sassy mouth, but she stayed alive because she knew how to cook some chicken. So, she was born into that environment. So, you know, she had the yellow fever epidemic that basically took Memphis out the mouth for several years. She lost that charter because so many people died. But at the age of 16, Ida B. Wells was able to take care of her five brothers and sisters by herself, get a job, you know, as a teacher, travel the miles into the cities to teach people, to provide for her siblings. And Ida B. Wells Barnett is very interesting because if you read her diary when she was a young woman, I mean, I think it's important that sisters understand the value of Ida B. Wells Barnett. Because she was in a world where women were not allowed to be people. You know, for her to be a journalist and to own her own business as a newspaper operator was a big ado for any woman in 19th century America. You know, that was a big thing. And to be a former slave and do that was incredible. But Ida B. Wells was a person that she didn't always seek the spotlight. The spotlight saw her because she had principles. She refused to back down. For example, when she was riding a train car in the 1880s, she refused to removed from a train car reserved for white people. Now, this is 70 plus years before Rosa Parks refused to rule from the seat on the bus in Montgomery. But she did this back in the 1880s. She beat the train conductor on the hand. They threw out the train eventually, but she won the case in lower court. But it was reversed in the Tennessee Supreme Court. So this is back in the 1880s she was doing this.
Which was unheard of.
Well, it was unheard of. As a matter of fact, no, I wouldn't say it was unheard of because Frederick Douglass was getting thrown out train cars in 1840. So this thing about the city and about the civil rights movement and then all this stuff, ever since a black person came to America in the 1600s, there's been a civil rights movement going on, a freedom movement. And,
I mean,
we had those that resisted.
Ida B. Wells, didn't she also get run out of Memphis?
Yeah, she got ran out of Memphis, but first she was a Memphis schools teacher. See, the black folks ran out of the school system because she was complaining a lot about how they treated black students and black teachers. The inadequate facilities, the lack of money and resources for them to really teach the kids. So the black folks got afraid because they said the white power structure is going to anger the white people in the city. So she lost her job as a school teacher because she refused to hold her tongue. Now, she actually owned a newspaper operation called the Free Speech and Headlight on Bill Street. You know, Bill Street is known as the home of the blues, whatever. But what happened to her was the reason why she got rid of the South was because she was an investigative journalist reporting on what we call lynching. You know, people getting killed. And people always get this misconception of what a lynching really is. People think that if you hang a person from a tree, that's a lynching. You don't have to hang from a tree. It's just a mutilation of the body, violating somebody's human and civil rights. That's what a lynching is. You just mutilate people and violate their human and civil rights without no due process of the quote-unquote law. So at first, she thought, like her close friend, Frederick Douglass, other day. These black men were getting killed because they were criminals. And then one day back, I want to say 1891, one of her best friends, Thomas Moss, a well-respected business leader in the community, was killed by a white lynch mob. Him and his two business associates ran a successful grocery store called the People's Grocery Store in Mississippi, mm-hmm. in historic South Memphis. And, you know, their competition was the white grocers across the street. And the People's Grocery Store, they were very popular, not only among black people, but all people. So they used to, you know, they got mad at them one night, these white folks, said, we want to make the money that these black people make. So they organized a vigilante mob to try to attack the store and attack the owners. So the owners, Thomas Moss, they had guns and stuff to protect their store. So they fired into the crowd and they injured some white people. So they turned themselves in, you know. By them turning themselves in, that was a big mistake because, you know, they was unarmed and they got lynched.
Mm.
And Thomas Moss had a little baby at that point, you know, he was a young man. Mm. But it's sad, you know, because I didn't say my friend got lynched because he had a successful business, not because he was raping white women. And one thing that Ida B. Wells brought to light was the fact that a lot of these white women were speaking out these black men, which was very taboo. Just like the Victorian area, you know, women, white women are the flower of the South, you know, they have the fact. Really think that white women were actually trying to have sex with black men, whoa, you're stepping over the line. And another thing that people don't know about how to do it on that day, she used to sign her journalist name was Aula. A lot of white people in the Memphis thought she was a man. But how to do it was a beautiful sister. She was about 5 feet or 5'1", and she would walk around Memphis with a bunch of guns, or two guns on her person.
That's what I felt fascinated about her. She carried two guns at all times.
Yeah, because she knew that her life was on the line. Because her father, she got to understand that she was born as a slave, but she wasn't born a slave. See, you hear people talk about slavery. I mean, like, people think that people are actually born with slavery in that DNA. No, she was born into the conditions, into an environment that told her that her people was nothing, but she was raised by a very strong black parent. They had pride in themselves. Her father was a very strong leader in the black community in Holly Springs. Now, as a matter of fact, he was a good friend of Robert Church Sr., who was the first self-made black millionaire in the South, who actually brought, you know, the city of Memphis back from the yellow fever epidemic.
Wow.
First in the first city charter. So she had very, you know, strong black male influences in her life, not strong black woman models in her life to look at. So she wasn't by no means a coward. And sometimes, though, she thought, like in her Memphis diary, she thought she would never be married because, you know, she didn't know if any man would accept her for being who she was.
Wow.
Because she was a firecracker, boy. I mean, even, you know, Frederick Douglass was afraid. He's like, wow. But what I like about how to do with Barnett is that she wasn't afraid to speak her mind, and she called a spade a spade. Like Susan B. Anthony, you know, the famous woman, the feminist, right?
Right.
A lot of people know Susan B. Anthony was a racist. You know what I'm saying? She really looked down on black people, in particular black men. When they had a feminist convention down in Atlanta, Frederick Douglass, his second wife was a white woman. Be a secretary by the same age as his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And Frederick Douglass was a feminist. So he was one of the early feminists in this country. So if you don't understand what a feminist is, whatever, but he was one of the early supporters of women's suffrage, or women's rights to vote. And he wanted to make an appearance at the convention down in Atlanta. And Susan B. Anthony said, no, we can't let you have that. Can't let you come in because you might upset the white women. So Andy Wells went into her and said, how dare you do that to him? That, I mean, she just went off. If you ever read any of Ida B. Wells' writings, it's very brilliant. And the thing about where she came from is incredible. Because the way she was able to communicate ideas, because like somebody told me, your words create worlds. And there's no greater educator than the press, because the people must know before they can act. And you look at her mindset now, it applies to what's going on in the press right now. How unfortunate. Because with the Thomas Moss incident, she told people what was the time was, what they were trying to do. Black people in Memphis. They're trying to keep us in our place. They're trying to keep us from holding elected office, from running successful businesses, from controlling our community. She urged all black folks to leave Memphis and to go out west to Kansas and Oklahoma and California. Over 6,000 black folks left Memphis because of her.
Wow.
It's the power of the press.
That is the power of the press. Wow.
Yeah.
You brought up Frederick Douglass quite a bit, so let's talk about him. He was 1818 to 1895.
There has not been a movie made. I do understand why there has not been a movie made. But like Frederick Douglass' life is astonishing. Because he came from nothing and made something. But really, Black folks to co-sign on the call. So you had two, the only two women I think I mean, I guess you had two sisters from Memphis. Yeah, Ida B. Wells, that's signed to call, and Mary Church Terrell, another wonderful sister that I don't even know about, who was the daughter of Robert Church. Two on the first black woman to obtain a college degree. She got a college degree from Oberlin because she spoke German and French and Italian fluently. She's a brilliant sister. But they didn't agree with it. Ida B. Wells just put the NAACP because she said we need a black organization that advocated for black people that was ran and controlled by black folks. And Wayne Moreau tried to agree with her, too.
Really? And he went on to found the National Equal Rights League, didn't he?
Yes, he did. I mean, he did things to try to, you know, try to make people aware. It's kind of like he saw the future of where all this was going. Because people don't understand that this point in the early 20th century and the late 19th century was like a very severe moment for black America. You had black folks being lynched every day to hell in this country somewhere. You know, they had black folks like whatever down in Alabama. You had black men being set up on false charges and put on chain gangs. At the beginning of the last century, Birmingham, Alabama was the fastest growing city in America because the steel mines, all this stuff. What they was doing was in slavery. They was reinforcing slavery because they had black men brought on trouble charges and put them on a chain gang and went into the cage and whatnot. And these guys work like, kind of like in the movie Life with Eddie Murphy and Ron Lewis. They just work from sun up to sun down, and so they end up getting sent. They won't make it out alive by the time. They just die. So you got a lot of mass burial graves around Birmingham, where a lot of black men would work, you know, work the fields and mines for the night, and make their family just get mines. So there are letters in the Library of Congress where black people have written, like President Theodore Roosevelt and other presidents, about what happened to their sons. Or nephew, or uncle, or father, they went unanswered. And you read some of this stuff, it's kind of spooky. The thing about black folks, all they know they're conscious because they still have faith in the government. And they still do have faith in the government now, a lot of black folks, I don't understand.
If you just tuned in, you've come to the stage tonight for the topic, A Real Black History Lesson. We're talking with Brother Ronald Hurd II. He's an artist, an activist. Also, he calls himself an archivist and a fellow Blog Talk Radio host, and he's a historian. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at www.AfricanAmericanNewsAndCommentary.com. A reminder, the chat room is open tonight, so if you have a question or a comment, you can post it up in bold in chat, and I will present it to Mr. Hurd before the end of the evening. Let's move on. Marcus Garvey, very famous young man.
He was
a Jamaican born, 1887 to 1940. Tell us about Marcus Garvey.
Marcus Garvey was a very interesting guy. You know, he had one of them stories growing up where everybody realized that they were not like the other people, like the white people. Because when he was growing up, his playmates were white. You know what I'm saying? He had a crush on a white girl. I mean, then one day, the white father stopped bringing the white kids around. And he got his wake up call that he was not white. And he was considered less than. Well, Marcus Garvey, he's another cat because he started his own newspaper press and stuff like that. He had a media background. He understood the power of the media to influence the mind. And also, Marcus Garvey was a big admirer of Booker T. Washington. Now, a lot of people, when we think of Booker T. Washington, a lot of us today, we think he was an Uncle Tom, a sellout. He was trying to hold black people back. But if you understand the psychology of a Booker T. Washington, he understood white folks better than they understood themselves. You gotta remember, he was born into slavery. He was working in the big house, the White House. I mean, like the White House, white slave in the home. So he understood the psychology of white people. That's what his Atlanta Compromise speech was all about. To be separate as the fingers in all things social, but one in all things mutual to our progress and survival. So he was preaching about ownership of stuff. Black folks, there's honor in tilling the field as well as learning how to read and write poetry. That's what he's trying to get us to see. And Marcus Garvey believed in what he was doing, but he read over several correspondences about how to start his own black organization in Jamaica. And his plan was to meet Booker T. Washington in America in the 1910s. Unfortunately, Booker T. Washington passed away in 1915, and Marcus got here, I believe, around 1916 and decided to stay here. And what I love about Marcus Garvey is that he understood that before people could be anything, they must believe they could be anything. The And I always tell people, so they want to blast Booker T. Washington, if Garvey followed Washington, Malcolm X's parents were both Garveyites. Black Muhammad people were Garveyites before they became black Muslims. Muhammad Ali's parents believed in Garveyism. And that all came out of the philosophy of Booker T. Washington.
He, too, was considered a publisher, journalist, entrepreneur, and a great orator, right?
Yeah, he was a brilliant orator. He was one of our greatest mass leaders of all time, period. Like I said, he was able to galvanize people. He didn't have no Facebook or no internet or no social media network. He wasn't on the radio all the time, but he was able to galvanize. Just listen to his speech, him doing his own speech, and what he talked about. I mean, it's kind of like you look at somebody like Bishop T.D. Jakes. Now, it's somebody like who can just galvanize people and catch their imagination and make them believe in certain things. I mean, he was a phenomenal, he was a force of nature.
They called him a separatist, though. And they also said that the Klan supported him. Did you find that in your research as well?
Oh, yeah, the Klan did support him. But also, the Nation of Islam met with the Klan back in the 60s to buy land out of Georgia. I mean, politics made some strange spares of him. I mean, God was, he understood the situation he was dealing in. And he advocated a back to Africa movement. And like Dago Hoover, you know, when Marcus was at his pinnacle, Dago Hoover was just a pistol pusher in Washington, D.C. A bureaucrat. But they did things to undermine that movement. Like, they put stuff in his fuel and his black star line paint to mess up the ships and whatnot. And also, I talked about some of the black leadership were not accepting of some of his ideas. And Marcus, you know, he had some interesting ideas, but he lacked in the economic part of his philosophy. And yet, you had people that might have could have helped him, like Dr. Du Bois, one of his books from the 40s, made out an interesting economic plan. Instead of them trying to help them, they brought them down. They brought them low. And he was dealing with the white power strips. They set them up on mail fraud.
Mm-hmm.
They thought, you know, they did away with Brother Marcus.
Wow. They were set up. Coming out of the chat room was to ask you to comment on Leo Hansberry and to ask you, do you know the history of Fort Doran in Alabama?
I know who William Leo Hansberry is. That's Lorraine Hansberry's uncle. He's one of the great Egyptologists. I mean, he's a brilliant African scholar. And he's from Mississippi, Emmett County. If you know, are you familiar with civil rights movement history, you know that they had a couple cold cases down there. Louis Allen and Mustafa Magistar had his couple cold cases. They got civil rights history. But Leo Hansberry was a foremost scholar of African history, and he was a premier Egyptologist. He was very brilliant. I mean, he was smart in some so-called white scholars on the topic. I mean, really nobody in the country could educate him about the history. But he ended up being a mentor to, like, President Kwame Nkrumah and also the President of Nigeria at the time. So he taught Africans about African history.
And then he said, if you could tell the story behind Camp Von Doren in Mississippi.
Oh, Camp Von Doren. Well, you know, there was a big massacre at Camp Van Doren down in Mississippi. It's actually near the Louisiana border.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 40s, the black GIs were slaughtered by the military police and by the command at Camp Van Doren.
Mm-hmm.
You got black, I mean, people at NACP and stuff looked into it. It was a white Mississippian, Carol Case, that actually wrote the story. Yeah, I remember in college reading about it, creating a firestorm back in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I think he wrote the book in 98. He said he got it from an old security guard that worked at his bank. He was a bank president at one point. That security guard told him what happened in Camp Van Doren back in, I guess, the summer of 43, I believe it was. And basically what they were saying was the reason why they killed all them black GIs, they were the troublemakers, the rebel rouse. You know, the military was very concerned about the morale. You know, we had war. You got these uppity black folks complaining about the conditions that they were facing in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So the military was very segregated. You talk to any, if you have the luck of talking to any veteran in World War II about the conditions, you know, of the military at the time and the race relations, it's deplorable. It was a big, hidden, open secret about how they treated blacks in the military. So a lot of these soldiers, they know from the north, they weren't from the south, and they say, you know what, we ain't gonna be treated like this. So as the story goes, one night, you know, they took away all their guns, whatever. So they had a couple of incidents in the town where Camp Van Doren is at, where actually, I believe a sheriff shot one of the GIs in cold blood.
Mm.
You know, but I mean, like, now, the NHP looked into it. I think I seen Congressman Jimmy Thompson look into it. And people trying to say it was a hoax, but you got people, you know, they've been hearing about historical decades. Got some old time to talk about it. You know, to me, something happened. But what happened, I don't know. But people got killed. And so they said it's a big mass burial ground in that area.
Wow.
Down there. You know, and he's just like, it's so much stuff. Like, I heard in World War One, I wrote a book about a guy named James Free Shrup, who was I call him the Jazz Lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the first back to play Carnegie Hall. He actually brought jazz to Europe. But they said in World War One, it was investigated by this guy named Emmett Scott, who worked at Tuskegee. He wrote a pamphlet, mailed to the Library of Congress, but they were saying that the Red Cross refused to treat black people that were wounded. A lot of black soldiers died because the white Red Cross nurses would not treat them for injuries.
Wow.
So you hear stuff like this all the time. Mm-hmm.
This story was the basis of the soldier story.
Was the camera back on?
That's just one of the comments coming out of the chat room. This story was based on.
I don't know what the basis, because this story was just known in the 90s. Soul stories, I think that movement, so Denzel and all them guys came out, Adolf Caesar, came out in the early 80s, I believe. But that story didn't start having circulation until like the late 90s, because of Carol Cates, the white man who wrote about it, you know, based on the testimony he got from several people. And you can't really trust the military when it comes to official stories or truths, because the military always lying about stuff. Mountain Bayou, Mississippi, which was founded by former slaves, one of the oldest black communities in the country. one thing about Dr. Tim Howell, he gave Megan Evans his first job as an insurance salesman. Megan Evans and his wife used to work for Dr. Tim Howell and one of his insurance agencies.
Wow.
You know, he had a restaurant, he had a zoo for blacks to go to. Dr. Tim was a founder of the Regional Council of Negro Leadership. That was like a black leadership organization in the Delta. But you got to think about it. You know, just back in the 1950s, he organized the Regional Council of Negro Leadership. They had 10,000, 20,000 black people coming every year for a barbecue and to talk about voter rights and about black ownership.
Wow.
This is before Freedom Summer. This is before all this other stuff that people think about when they think about the grass movement. They had black folks among themselves organizing themselves. So he'll bring in people like Mahalia Jackson for entertainment, Thurgood Marshall, Representative Charles Diggs, Representative Alton Powell Jr., Thurgood Marshall. All these people come down there to speak to these people and empower these people to keep on making that push. Dr. Howell was at the forefront of that. When the White Citizen Council tried to put a credit freeze on some of the entrepreneurs involved in the Mississippi Freedom Movement, what they did was they went up to Memphis to try State Bank. Now, Dr. King, in his last speech, talked about supporting black businesses. He said the SCLC has an account with the Tri-State Bank of Memphis. And this is why black businesses were important, because when the white folks said that the black folks cannot get a loan to grow their crops or to run their businesses from the white bank, they said, we're going to go up to Memphis, we're going to go to the black-owned bank to get credit. So Dr. T.I. Powell with the NAACP were able to get these applicants credit for their businesses. So they were able to do these things on thrive.
How you doing?
narcissism.
That's the kind of person I like. I want to ask you a couple of things, though. Have you ever heard of C.R. Patterson?
Yes, he was a communist leader. He was a big major player with Paul Robeson in trying to get the United States brought up on human rights violations.
I mean, one of them involved with automobiles. You know, you had a slave by the name of C.R. Patterson that was building automobiles, building what was called the Jenny.
Okay.
Before Henry Ford was. He was in Greenfield, Ohio. And you mentioned about Marcus Garvey. But Marcus Garvey had a friend by the name of Hubert Julian. Hubert Julian was called the Black Eagle. He was scheduled. He was a pilot. He was scheduled to make a transatlantic flight across a flight from United States to Europe 3 years before Charles Lindbergh was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's a lot of history that we never do hit up on. And you know another thing too, when the Montgomery bus boycott was going on, blacks in Winston-Salem, North Carolina had a bus line that had over 500 buses.
Wow.
It was called the Safe Bus Company. It started in the 1920s and finally went out of business, I think, in 1972. And this bus company was so efficient that white bus companies could not even compete with it. And if I'm not mistaken, I think one of the white companies at the time was called the Duke something. And, you know, it's been such a much possibility because Duke Power and Light is the major source for electricity on the East Coast around the area of North Carolina.
So, you know, let me ask you this then. Compared to the resources we have now, you know, to the resources they had back then, how is it that you think blacks were making so many strides back then and were so entrepreneurial in their spirit, and we don't see that as much today? I mean, we see more people looking for someone to give them a job than they were back then. People back then were creating jobs.
I don't know. You know, you talk about Collie House. Now, Collie House had over 400,000 members in her organization. And what brought her down was the Postmaster General, because all her communication had to go through the Postal Service. And what happened, they just stopped it. And that was before text messaging, internet, and cell phone.
Right.
And her organization, actually, the remnants of it went into what would become the UNIA with Marcus Garvey and so forth.
You know, they did the same thing when they did the Marcus Garvey.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know,
mail fraud thing. They mailed it out to the mail.
Another thing that you did mention, you mentioned about the Black Cross nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And the Black Cross nurses came about because the white nurses would step over the black soldiers during World War One and wouldn't attend to them. And I think it was some of my leaders at the time, you might correct me, I think it might have been Du Bois and them that looked at that.
And yeah, they tried to get Du Bois, they tried to shut him up about it, though.
Yeah.
They were trying to throw him in jail and stuff, so he had to go along to get him. But Emmett Stein from Tuskegee, he went over there doing it. I mean, he got found and stuff in the Library of Congress. He said he couldn't find no instance of that happening. You already know what the real deal is.
So. Oh, yeah. Because General Pershing, made the statement, and you can damn near quote it. He said, just because your leaders want you to serve, you know, in the military, in combat, it won't change the condition of your lot. And that's doggone prevail. Now I want to ask you one more question, and I hope that everyone listening is getting this. Did you ever hear of the race riots that was going on during the Vietnam era on the USS Enterprise, U.S. Constellation, and with a couple other frigates that black soldiers would fight white sailors at the time, and these fights lasted for hours on these ships. Yeah. Because you know the race riots that was going on the military bases in Germany, blacks and white soldiers going at each other.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I've never heard of that, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. But I really appreciate you, sir, and I mean, keep up the good work by all means, because we need, you know, people to tell stories like you are, and don't, we don't have to revise them. All we need to do is just tell the truth.
Yeah,
tell the truth. again, another sister born into slavery, but she was actually a brilliant educator. She wrote a thing called The Voice of the South. It talks about being a black woman and education and stuff like that. But she actually was a principal at M Street High School, which is now known as Dunbar High School, one of the top performing schools in the country. It's not a turn of last century. That she was older, you know, black or white. And what I love about her is her determination, because around the age of 64, 65, she got her PhD.
60 what?
64, 65, around that age, about 1924, she got her PhD. And, you know, people say, you know, you're never too old. I say you're never too old if you start now. And she lived to be 100 pounds years old.
That's crazy. They said that she was an author, educator, speaker, and a prominent black scholar in our history?
Yes, she was. She was very highly respected in the D.C. area. Like I said, she ran M Street High School for about 7 years. And like, there was at one point, one of the top performing high schools in the country, black or white.
Really?
You know, it was a great high school. There's a lot of great people that came out there because of Jim Crow, because, you know, if you was a black educator, it was hard for you to get a job in white institutions. So, I mean, a lot of black schools, contrary to popular belief, were very well-known powerhouses. They produced some phenomenal talent, both faculty and students.
Love that. Love that. Wow. Let's talk about Miss Harriet Tubman. Everybody knows her, but Ronald tells her story like nobody else. Let's talk about Harriet Tubman, 1820 to 1913.
Right, it's amazing that she lived that long because she actually saw some phenomenal changes in her lifetime. We just think about that period. The fact that we're not even 100 years yet to her anniversary of her death shows you how recent slavery was and how real it was for so many African American people. And what I love about Harriet Tubman, a lot of people understand that she was a minister. You know, she was a minister. So that's why people say she's the Moses of her people. She was a prophet. So, but I think about Harriet Tubman, like she said, to paraphrase her, you know, if she could have convinced more people that they were slaves, she could have freed thousands more.
I love that.
I mean, that she had to force people at gunpoint, literally, just to want to be free. But most got afraid and want to turn around. And a lot of times, that's the psychology of a, you know, scared person. Because they're like, you know, you're catching hell. At least I know what this hell is all about. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The unknown, the new, is like, you set somebody free, like a friend of mine told me, like, you lock up a wild dog and spot him in a basement for years, and you set him out free onto the world. What's the dog going to do? You know what I'm saying? What's the apparatus? Because freedom ain't really free. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, she had to force people at gunpoint as well. She said, hey, you're not going back to master, but I'll drop you where you stand right now. And make that your resting place. So, needless to say, she just lost one person on her express. But one thing about Harriet Tubman when she was a fighter, when she was fearless, because she could have, you know, countless times just gave up and just, you know, sought freedom for herself. To be successful is very much to be selfish. But the only thing that requires you to be great is to serve.
Wow, love that.
That's how you become great, you know, and there's few people that are really, truly great that are successful.
Now, she made about 13 missions to rescue more than, what, like 70 slaves?
Well, you know, who knows the number? I mean, the fact that you look at this way, you know, she may have rescued maybe 70 slaves, but look how many generations. Let me think about the impact. You know, I don't like to deal with numbers when it comes to us a lot of times because they always underestimate the numbers. You know what I'm saying? That's never exact. The numbers don't lie, but people do. And for good reason.
It's true.
But an example, I mean, think about if we had more Harriet Tubman.
Never heard.
Dropped dead 1 year before the Cut into really understand how important he was to Dr. King and to the movement. He said that all that Dr. King could think about was what would happen to Coretta and the kids. So Harry Belafonte was a big fundraiser for Dr. King. You know, he also paid for the funeral of Dr. King. And he also, with Coretta, picked out his suit that he was going to be left lying in his casket. So Harry Belafonte took care of Dr. King's family. So, like, that's why people understand, like, why it was a big deal when Coretta Dr. King's funeral was held in 2006. Mm-hmm. And Harry Belafonte didn't want to know, or he was disinvited, whatever you want to call it. And he played such a pivotal role in the Dr. King legend.
Bottom.
But somebody from SCLC called and told him to change the room, 306. years later, now we know that the secretary, she controls Dr. King's schedule, itinerary, and his brother named James, well, Jimmy Harrison, was an FBI informant. He actually met the FBI the day Dr. King got killed. But he was responsible for Dr. King's itinerary. That means he could change it whenever he wanted to. It could alert certain people about the word about Dr. King. Because even in a local news station, they told people Dr. King was staying there. He's in room 306 of a Rainbow Tail. That's kind of unusual. He got people close to him saying that they were doing certain things. That's exactly, for example, was not, you know, on the balcony when Dr. King got killed. He was in the courtyard.
Wow.
But yeah, he ended up with blood on his shirt the next day in Chicago, you know, top of the news people and stuff. But, you know, you got to think about it. When Dr. King got shot, this was shut down. It was locked down. He had martial law. Yet Jesse Jackson was able to get a plane that night and go, you know, do all the morning shows in Chicago. I'm not saying I'm the family, but you know what it is. Billy Cowles, another guy from Chicago, who's a well-known minister in Memphis. Now, he made a documentary recently that was important and going about a civil rights museum here. It's called, I guess, Witness Room 306, whatever. Now, he claims he was in the room with Dr. King in his last hour of life. But everybody that was there, who had their own testimony, said Dr. King did not meet with Billy Cowles the last hour of his life. And Billy Cowles, like, he did was went to Dr. King's room and knocked on the door. And Rapper Abner, even in his own autobiography, said that, you know, he just came to the door and let him know that, hey, we got to get, you know, going to my house for dinner. You're not going to the room and sit down with these guys. And Dr. King was in a strategy meeting with the SCLC leadership about what to do, you know, for about 40-something minutes of his life, last hour of his life. Billy Cowles, go ahead.
So some people have basically changed what the actual occurrences for their own benefit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, being a martyr in business is bad business. It don't benefit the person that's a martyr. You're dead. It don't make a difference either way. You know, you got to be smart about the situation. Because, like, also, I read the testimony of Captain Willie B. Richmond, who was, like, keeping a surveillance for, you know, what was going on along the line. He's a police officer. And he took notes that he didn't see Bill Cowles going to the room. He said Bill Cowles went up the stairs and notified them and said, got you ready to go. You know, he was like, yeah, the court testimony of Billy Cowles back in 99, when they had the assassination trial in Memphis. They cross-examined Billy Cowles. They caught him in his own lie. They could not find that transcript anywhere. The King Foundation didn't have a link to that transcript. They took it down.
The photographer Withers, later it came out that he was an FBI informant.
That's what they say, but Whittle was one of the first black Memphis police officers. And, you know, he was one of the first five, whatever. And, you know, if it was an informant, I look at it like this, right? You know, I look at, he's a freelance photographer. Somebody pay you money to take pictures of you. You bring a picture back to him. They ask you, now who are these people in this picture? Well, that's so-and-so, so-and-so. Where do you take this picture of the time? So, I mean, like, you know, they make it look like he was a mastermind. Which he was. He was a punk.
Really?
You know,
but he wasn't an informant.
He was, he was something, because if they got the stuff they got on him, he provided some type of information. So what we won't ever know is what type of information did he provide.
Okay.
You know, I thought if you know close to Dr. King, I think Gregory got all, you know, you think he's a Judas. Whereas somebody like Reverend C.T. Vinny said that Ernest Withers did more good than harm. He helped teaching folks about the movement, about his pictures. Because the pictures tell the story. Reverend C.T. Vinny was more pissed off about Jim Harrison being an FBI informant because he was on the SCLC payroll. Getting health benefits and everything. He betrayed the trust of a lot of people in that circle.
Wow, that's incredible. I don't know, I saw something on CNN about that Withers, James Withers, and I think Conan O'Brien did something with Dick Gregory, and they were saying that Withers was, an FBI.
Well, how many people know? I'll tell you about Withers. Withers is interesting. Because he took the photograph at the Emmett Till trial. Yeah, he took the picture of Emmett Till's great uncle, Moses Wright, pointing to the white folks that killed or dragged his nephew to his early death. He said, there they be. And
James
everybody
Withers,
knows,
for
black
those
man
testified
in Mississippi was defined. Huh?
I was trying to explain who James Withers was. Tell them who he was.
Earl Withers was a photographer. He was like one of the most prolific photographers. Consider him the dean of the civil rights photographer. He took a lot of famous pictures. He developed that famous picture of Dr. King laying on the balcony of a Rainbow Tail with people pointing across the street.
Yeah.
Now, he had people that were there, like Ron Caldwell and Reverend Zane Orr, said they saw the shot come from the bushes. And it was a white guy that ran out. Matter of fact, before he also really admire Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson, another, I think one of the first, I think he was the first black All-American football player. You know, he's a brilliant person, a lawyer, actor, singer. Paul Robeson is a person that people need to know more about. But the powers that be want to keep him so quiet for a reason. He's a guy that featured Henry Belafonte and Ozzy Davis. And, I mean, he was a giant of a man. So Malcolm really admired Paul Robeson, you know, he, like how he articulated, you know, and all this other stuff. So Malcolm is interesting because Malcolm, to me, was ahead of every black leader we had. Because he understood that the struggle had to be international. And we had a connection like Garvey before the motherland. But actually, he had a plan. He already initiated something. That's why he's a threat. Because he wanted to bring up, I think, the charges of human rights violations before he got assassinated. And you know, it was an inside hit. You know, we all thought the movement did it, but you know, it was state sponsored because it was just that he was denying entry to places like France and stuff like that. So at the end, he tried to contact the 2 weeks. He contacted the State Department 2 weeks before he was assassinated. Said he was his life was in danger. And Malcolm knew he was a marked man, but his thing was, I gotta create this organization so I'll be more dangerous dead than alive. That's the Organization of Afro American Unity.
Wow.
And he was killed before that happened, but. So the reason why Malcolm was so dangerous is because he was going up to different places in Africa. And he had, like, leadership from these different countries quote him on their floors of their houses or parliament or whatever, or even quote him in the UN. He had to go. He was a good friend with Che Guevara and all that stuff. He met with Castro in Harlem. Malcolm was a very interesting guy. And, you know, one thing I love about Malcolm, I get from the fact that he was honest. He was an honest leader. Like, he could admit when he made a mistake. And that's rare for a lot of, you know, leaders to do. To admit when they make a mistake, and he was willing to change and grow. Not just change, but people always say, well, you know, he stopped hating white people. Well, white people hated black people. Malcolm was responding to the hate, if you want to call it that. You know, like, they got this documentary called The Hate Game Produced that Mike Wallace did. You know, and they showed the Nation of Islam. See, the Nation of Islam, all this stuff was produced as a reaction to what white folks were doing specifically to black people. The black church was produced because of the fact that white folks didn't want black people to worship with them in the same congregation. So, you know, he had in 1891 a walkout by African Jones and Richard Allen, all these guys, and they formed the African Methodist Episcopal Church in response to white racism within the church. Like Dr. King said, the most segregated hours is when church is on. You know, they do a church worship service, right?
Right.
That's the most segregated time in America.
But I think, from what I understand about Malcolm's history, Malcolm came from, like, a radical, like, family. His father had been kind of radical.
He was a Garveyite. You know what I'm saying? Like, they were followers of Garvey. You know, his father was a minister who was an advocate for Marcus Garvey. For Garveyism. He was a Garveyite.
Because his father was rumored to have been killed by a white supremacist, and his uncle was lynched, I understand. So
all his uncles died violently. Everyone his uncles died violently. So he figured that he was going to die violently, too.
And his mother, they said, went into a mental hospital, and he ended up growing up in a foster home, he and his siblings.
Right, because he was a kid, and Malcolm was, like, a top student in class, and one day that teacher told him, you know, niggas can't be lawyers, Malcolm. Why not be a cop? Jesus was a cop. Let you know that Jesus was black. You know?
I heard she told him that it wasn't a goal for a black person to want to be a lawyer. I mean, can you imagine telling that to Malcolm X when he was a kid? That's crazy. But a teacher really told him.
But they told that to Thurgood Marshall, too. They wouldn't let him enter the University of Maryland.
Wow. Now, the strange thing, you know, you interviewed Malcolm's nephew, didn't you?
Yeah, Rodell Collins, yes.
And he told an interesting piece of history that I've never heard about Malcolm X, but he said that Malcolm X was a male prostitute before he was Malcolm X, I guess when he was Malcolm Little. Is that what he said?
Or Detroit Red. Yeah, he said that. Actually, that rumor's been around for almost 20 years now, because if you look at before Manny Marable made his admission of it, he had contributed his back to Carl Evans, who used to be a reporter for the Washington Post. He had a couple books out in the 90s that talk about that. And Roger Collins, so we got that from Malcolm's running buddy, Malcolm Shorty Jarvis, the kid that Spike Lee portrayed in the movie, Malcolm X. And he said that, you know, Malcolm used to mess around with rich white men for money with him. And he got to understand, too, that how we view sexuality now was totally different back then. Like, he might have performed a homosexual act, whatever, but he didn't consider himself gay. You know what I'm saying? It was an act. And also, like, I always tell people this, critically think about what you're thinking about. Because if he was a male prostitute, Now, you gotta think about Thomas Jefferson was like one of the most popular and famous white men in the country. intention of being like a Rush Limbaugh. So I can tell him just as much influence over people, but it's not about black people. Mm-hmm. And so Tom Jones was saying, you know, he was screwing black women and Monticello. You know what I like about Tom? You know what I like about hypocrisy? Because they'll tell you that Thomas Jefferson was a Renaissance man. They said Thomas Jefferson was a farmer, but who planted the crops? They said Thomas Jefferson was an architect, but who built Monticello? They said Thomas Jefferson was a musician, but who played at his ball? Give the white man all the credit, and the Negroes do all the work. So Thomas Jefferson, he was saying that black folks was inferior, even though he knew better than that, because he was friends with Benjamin Banneker, the guy who helped, you know, create Washington, D.C. You know, so he said if we don't answer Thomas Jefferson right now, then look at how many other generations will be deferred the opportunity to really be what he's supposed to be. So you know, he appealed, and he got white folks scared. He got mayors from north to south and governors. It's not just with a white man alone. It's not going to Negro right like this.
Somebody wrote in the chat room, the David Walker appeal?
Yeah, the David Walker appeal to the culture of the world. Yeah, that's it. You know what's saying about that is that if you go to the library right now, that book probably has not been checked out since 1972.
Really?
That book is so powerful. It's like it's up there with any American document that was ever written. It's up there with Thomas Paine. Because basically you tell them black folks to rebel. But he has white folks writing the mayor of Boston, governor, and mayor sniffed out saying, who is this David Walker guy? Why is this white guy trying to arouse the Negroes? Because, you know, he didn't have no social media back then, so what he used to do is have sailors, both black and white, they will come and get the books and distribute them throughout the different towns and harbors they would visit. And if it was caught sometimes that book, you might have been put to death. He even had, you know, people like, you know, a lot of slaves cannot read, so they'll go to churches and read it to the slaves.
He also was an activist that demanded an immediate end to slavery, you know, which was not heard of back then.
Right, he did. We just think about around time he was existing, but we did not.
You have to do what?
Where did he die?
I'm sorry, you repeat that. He has to do what? You can.
Not the what year did he die?
Was that what?
What year did he die? What year did David Walker die?
David Walker died in 1830.
Okay, what happened in 1831?
You're the historian, tell us.
All right, Nat Turner, insurrection in Virginia.
Okay.
Nat Turner was a black man who was a minister who was born to slavery, who led a revolution in Virginia that killed about 60 white people. Mm. He could read and write. The David Walker appeal was very powerful to influence people like Nat Turner and other folks to act and rebel.
Mm.
So that's why they had to shut up David Walker. When they found David Walker died in 1830, they don't know how he really died. It just found a dead in his house.
Wow. One thing that's consistent is all these black leaders, the great ones, the really great ones that were really revolutionaries back in their time, somehow they died. And in a lot of cases,
right.
Violently.
Unknown causes, right. Right. But you think about this, though, like what you're doing, Sister Carrie, with the media. They understood the value of media, of ownership, of trying to get the word out there and articulating the own world through the media. Money, the banks wouldn't lend him any money. Nobody called the bank. His name was Banksman. bigger homes on top of it. And his family's still fighting for control of his land. They took the landings and they destroyed them.
Wow.
You know? It's back in 1954.
Well, black history ain't pretty. Let's talk about Sojourner Truth. 1797 to 1883.
Sojourner Truth was very interesting. Get money secured for the building of that place. And in 1960, 1931, he was on his way to work. He was assassinated by two black men.
Wow.
Somebody punched him in his face, and the other guy shot him.
Wow.
And although they caught these two black men, they wouldn't let go.
Wow.
And they faded into history. But everybody knew and understood who Rosa Phillips was. He was a people's advocate. He was assassinated by the powers that be.
Mm.
And when the facility was once was completed in, like, I believe it was 37, it probably trained more black doctors than nurses any place in the country at that point.
I love that.
And, yeah, and also the person, one of the people he trained was Dr. Tim Howard at the hospital. Did, you know, he got his training there. And the person who directed the hospital was Henry Hampton Sr. He was the chief surgeon. And his son was Henry Hampton Jr. Now, Henry Hampton Jr. went on to create the Eisman Prize series, the documented civil rights movement, a brain theory. So that's really the legacy of Harlow Phillips, really. I mean, he trained, he provided health care for black people. He had to sacrifice himself for the cause.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, I just think it's a beautiful thing because you do things not for yourself, but you do it for others sometimes. And sometimes you might not get a chance to appreciate what you've done, like a Moses or somebody like that, or Abraham, whatever. But you have to start somewhere. Somebody's got to say, you know what, I'll take one for the team.
Because
we're going to get to the promised land together, like Dr. King said.
Absolutely.
For people.
Absolutely. That's Erica 314. Your phone line's back open.
Yeah, you know, Humble J. Phillips Hospital is not too far from me.
Really?
It's in the Ville neighborhood here in St. Louis. But, you know, did you ever hear about how George Washington Carver was castrated?
I heard about that, you know, in Arkansas. His mama was kidnapped by the night riders. They took her to the Ozarks where they saw him. They were
raised
by the former slave masters.
Right. They abandoned him alongside the road, and they came along and found him. And when he was raised by those slave masters, they didn't, I guess they didn't want him, you know, messing with their daughter, so they castrated him. Yeah. And another thing, you know what, I tell you what, that may have been why come he was such skillful in botany. You know, when people lose something, their body gives them, you know, spiritually something comes along that's outstanding about
them.
And you know,
right, you know, people want it, right?
Yeah, you're right. Hey, one other thing I wanted to mention, too. Now, look at those political parties. Now, early on in the history of this country, Republicans were at the forefront of all the Civil Rights Act back in 1866, 1875. It was Republicans that was voting overwhelmingly for this, those civil rights. Even in 1964, Republicans in both houses, Senate and Congress, outvoted Democrats for the Civil Rights Act. And you mentioned about Sumner. That was Sumner was a Republican from Massachusetts.
Right.
And the person that beat him up was a guy by the name of Preston Brooks, who was a Democrat from South Carolina.
Correct.
So Democrats were totally against blacks having, you know, that type of recognition. And you find it was no black first that came through Democrats prior to 1964.
Busing than after busing. Why do you think that is?
Well, because of integration, you know, the bus know, the lady, Lindy Wendell here in St. Louis that brought about that lawsuit about black schools not being adequately equipped, she never wanted black children to be bussed out of their community. And, you know, it's about competition. They would never give our children what they necessarily need where they can compete against their children. And when black children sat in the city of St. Louis public schools, that school would have got, say, $5,000. But when they went to the white schools say, look, if you want us to take these children, we want triple the amount that they would receive if they was in St. Louis. So the white districts was able to receive all that extra money, which they're burdening off the white families from passing bond issues to build the new schools that was built with all that extra money.
Okay, we're gonna pick up just a little bit more history, y'all. We're down to the last 10 minutes in the show.
All right, thank you.
We want to talk a little bit about Sam Cooke. You know, our guest is a musician. So, what is it about Sam Cooke that his history is so fascinating to you?
Well, Sam Cooke was a brilliant man. Like, he was from Chicago, but he really was born in Clarksdale, Mississippi. You know, so many great folks come out of the state of Mississippi. It's kind of weird. They have so much balance and just animosity towards black folks, but so many great black people got their start in Mississippi. And he grew up in Chicago. Well, I like myself for the fact that he understood the power of ownership, owning what you create, owning yourself, knowing who you are. So Sam Cooke was a very proud black man. He was like the first black artist, arguably, to own his own, like, master. And he had his own record label called SARS, a label that promoted people like Johnny Taylor and his old gospel group and Bobby Womack. So he was all about ownership. He was able to call his shots. He was a threat to the music industry. And that's why they had him killed. And also, he was very prominent in the civil rights movement. So his last song was Change Gonna Come. It got released, like, after his death, whatever. He died on December 11, 1964, under mysterious circumstances. Now, he cannot convince me otherwise that a hotel manager, a woman at that, was able to do the damage to Sam Cooke's body that was shown on his face. I mean, when they showed his body, he had, like, a very large lump on his head. And Ella James, the singer, said that his head was really decapitated from his body.
Wow.
His throat was crushed and stuff like that. You know, but you know, when he died, his wife sold the rights to his music and was cataloged to his business partner for like six figures, like $105,000, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine how much money that catalog generates on a yearly basis? Think about what happened recently to Michael Jackson, because before Michael Jackson died, he owned the rights to all the Beatles songs. As soon as he passed away, you could buy them now at the Apple Store for your iPod, the Beatles songs. So the thing about it, they'll kill you, because anything worth having is worth stealing.
Wow.
You know,
wasn't he the first to own his masters?
Fears, but they let their fears master their destiny. They could. But then stop us from getting on the airplane to become famous and great.
Very true. Well, let's move on to Otis Redding. We're down to our last, 6 minutes in the show. Otis Redding, 1941 to 1967. Singer, songwriter, a producer, arranger, and talent scout. Tell us about Otis Redding.
Well, Otis Redding, he started off as a chauffeur for people that was going to stack his audition, and he ended up auditioning and got the part. And what Otis Redding I like about him, he was 26 when he died, but he had the wisdom of an old man.
Wow.
So, when I talk to musicians that do Otis and work with Otis, they were telling me that, hey, Otis was trying to get us to own our music publishing rights.
Mm.
As a matter of fact, his brother is one of the top, music, blues music promoters in the country. Now, one of the top dogs, but Otis died, they said the airplane was actually engineered to go down.
No.
Kill Otis Redding. Yeah, because he was holding up a deal with Atlantic. Atlantic was going to buy stacks. And Otis was putting things in people's head about owning your publishing and all this stuff. And
if anybody is not familiar with who Otis Redding is, he's the one that wrote and performed that song, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Right, it was incomplete, but it's out of the classic now. He wasn't finished recording when he died. That song. Him and Sam Cooke. Their biggest hit came out and they died. And also, I'm going to add another person to that mix, Johnny Ace. Johnny Ace, a lot of people don't know who Johnny Ace was. Johnny Ace was from Memphis. But the reason why we know about B.B. King and Little Richard and Bobby Blueplant and Junior Parker because they all had to open for Johnny Ace if you want to get Johnny Ace. In the early 50s, Johnny Ace was the most popular black singer in the country, popular musician. And unfortunately, on Christmas night, December 25th, 1954, he put a gun to his hand. He was playing Russian Roulette, and he lost.
Wow.
So he took a break during the concert. His bandmate was Big Mama Thornton. That was his label mate. And she did, "You ain't nothing but a hound dog," and all that stuff. But she was in a room, in a dressing room down in Houston Civic Auditorium on Christmas night, 1954. He was playing around with his gun. Normally his gun is empty. It don't have any bullets in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, he would point a gun at people that joking and pull the trigger. If he was there, "Why don't you point that damn jump gun at yourself, Johnny?" "I'm going to show y'all there ain't nothing wrong with this gun." And then he shot himself, and they said his hair stood on him. He had propped his hair. They said his hair stood on him. He had this frozen, surprised look on his face. The gun went off, and he was just 25 years old when he died. And they had, a big funeral for him at Claiborne Temple. Actually, Ernest Withers was hired to be the publicist for the funeral.
Wow.
And, 5,000 people come to his funeral at Claiborne Church, or Claiborne Temple in Memphis. And he's buried at New Park Memorial, but this around the time that Elvis hit the scene in 65, but Elvis was influenced by Johnny Ace. Because the reason why Johnny Ace is so important is that he wrote a song and sung a song called Pledge My Love. It was custom, Ruth Brown, Sue, for this. It was custom when a black person made a hit song, that they have a white artist to cover it, and they'll play the white artist's copy on the black artist.
Absolutely.
So, they have one Hound Dog, Elvis Presley, then you look at Little Richard, and Pat Boone covered Tutti Frutti. It wasn't great.
90 seconds.
They started playing it with Johnny Ace. He was a black man that sounded like a white man. And they tried to cover his song. The white folks preferred his version of Pledge My Love. As a matter of fact, Pledge My Love was the last song that Elvis Presley ever recorded.
Wow.
Before he died. But even just as legend, I'm saying B.B. King, they started in the same group together on the Bill Streeters. And he had B.B. King, Junior Parker, Bobby Blue Bland, Roscoe Gordon, and Johnny Ace was the first person to make it big.
I cannot believe we got to him all tonight, y'all. I cannot even believe that. He wants to talk about Ike Turner, 1931 to 2007. What was so fascinating about Ike Turner?
So we got to be aware about how we look at people through the media, especially our black men. Our black men are under attack from all, attempts. Ike Turner was no exception. Ike Turner's story has been distorted beyond belief. This is really sad. All you got to do is really read for understanding how people do Ike Turner. Tina Turner's family was so crazy about Ike. And even Tina said that the way they portrayed Ike in her biopic, was over the top. That he wasn't that abusive. He was abusive. What happened to Ike Turner? Ike Turner's from Clarksdale, the same place where John Lee Hooker and Sam Cooke are also many great. When he was 4 years old, his father was a minister. His father said hello to a white woman. The white guy didn't like it, but they beat his father up. They literally put a hole in his father's stomach. So for his whole year, his father was lying in the bed and there was a hole in his stomach. And he finally died. And it had a very profound effect on Ike Turner because he was very close to his father.
Wow.
And when he was a young kid, around 8 to 12 years old, mind your performance. What people don't understand is, like, when you had Tina Turner in this group, you had white dudes from the industry always come and try to get her from Ike. Like, we want to make you a superstar. Like, kind of like Beyonce, whatever. We want to make you a star. We don't need these guys no more. They said, well, I can't do that because Ike, he my manager. Ike runs everything. But, like, Ike Turner, he was the talent scout for Sun Records, the same label that discovered Elvis Presley. Because what people don't understand about Sun Records, before they had Elvis, Sam Phillips wanted to record black musicians to make them popular among white buying people, white buying public. He wanted white folks to embrace black musicians. So the first musicians that recorded Sun Records were like people like Muddy Waters and B.B. King. They couldn't cross them over, but Ike Turner was a talent scout for Sun Records. As a matter of fact, Ike Turner started cutting the first rock and roll record, you know, Rocket 88, which was a song about Oldsmobile. It was very popular at the time. It was recorded with Jackie Brinson. So Ike Turner, I mean, he could play about every instrument you could think of. He was a brilliant musician. But somehow, because of just, you know, think about it. If the Turner name, Turner wasn't viable, why does Tina still support it? Why do you want to keep that name? Because it's music royalty. You know, the name Turner. Not a great Turner to me.
We have gone over, y'all. Listen, I have enjoyed tonight. Listen, like I told y'all, when I listen to Ronald Hurd, it just, like, mesmerizes me listening to him tell black history. Thank you so much, Ronald, for being with me. Tell them how to get to your website and tell them how to get to your Blog Talk Radio show.
I'm going to go to, that's a good question. I guess they can get my website, r2c2h2.com.
And your Blog Talk Radio show?
Blog Talk, just look up We All Be. One word, it's blogtalkradio.com, /, We All Be.
Thank you so much for being with me tonight. I really enjoyed it, and I hope y'all did too, because I learned a lot. I always do when I listen to him, and I thank you so much for spending time with me. It took me over a month to get him here, but we finally got it in, and it was worth every bit of the wait. Also, a reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. Also, a reminder, on 12:30, that's just a couple of days away from here, y'all, we're going to be doing a show called News Headlines of 2011. That's going to be a really great show. Also, we're going to go back-to-back with the next show being the 31st. We're going to deal with Is the Church Undercover? We have a group that's out of Memphis, Tennessee, again, that's going to be talking with us about how they're protesting against some of the ministers that are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. That should be a very interesting show. And the next show after that will be on January 6th. We're going to be doing End Time Prophecies. That one's going to be absolutely fascinating. A minister is going to come in and tell us what Revelation says about end time prophecies. He's going to break down Revelations and show us where we are in the book of Revelations in terms of what's going on with the New World Order. That's going to be a really great show. Again, thank you to Mr. Ronald Hurd, the second, for being with me tonight. Thank you, the audience, for listening. If you'd like to tell me how we're doing here at Center Stage, drop me a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. We want to know your thoughts about the show. And if you have a show idea or a comment about a previous show, drop me a line and let me know. Listen, I got to get out of here, y'all. We've gone over the